From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Tuesday, we'll see voters head to the ballot box or to caucuses in primaries or caucuses in three states. For Democrats, there's a primary in Arizona and caucuses in Idaho and Utah. For Republicans, there's a caucus in American Samoa and in Utah and a primary in Arizona. For more on all of this, we spoke with Professor Anthony Montero via Skype from Philadelphia Sunday.
It's been a busy week in terms of developments. We spoke last, just after the Tuesday primaries, and Sanders definitely not out. Rubio's bye-bye. Romney, for some reason, is doing an imitation of a zombie politician and chiming in all over. Some people are embracing the zombie as if that's going to help, and you can see the party machinery on both sides is really starting to start humming. They're working.
Yeah. Well, you know, both parties are more or less closed systems and run by professional politicians and have a command and control and strict discipline, which, of course, is fueled by Wall Street and oil money and other corporate money and is assisted by the corporate media. So any attempt to overthrow that that system is seen almost in revolutionary terms. I mean, and so especially on the Republican side, where the uprising against the elites has been so profound and so angry, the pushback to save the party is now becoming as angry and as concerted. So, I mean, you know, you have, and this is a great irony, almost an ambiguity, you have a manifestation of a class conflict within the Republican Party where the standard bearer of the working class and the lower classes and the white lumpen proletariat is a billionaire. It's a great irony, but nonetheless, to see this uprising as anything other than a form of class conflict within the Republican Party is to miss the significance of what is going on. Now, of course, because it is white and because it is Republican, it brings all of the baggage of 50 years of Republican racist mobilization of white working people. So it's not surprising that Trump mouths racist ideas about immigrants and Muslims. But none of that should be allowed to obscure what is going on. And of course, on the Democratic side, it's clearer that Bernie Sanders represents an uprising of more conscious elements of the white working class. And with Bernie, he's joined by large numbers of young people, which makes what he is doing a lot more compatible with the way the left generally thinks about progress and social conflict and class conflict.
You know, I mean, you're seeing, in a sense, almost a caricature form, but a replay of the battle on the ground, the intra-class battle on the ground among the working class in Germany, with, you know, one group following the left and another following Hitler. But you have... which you mentioned earlier, last week when we spoke, among the millennials who were at the core of this Sanders movement campaign, this huge, you know, it's maybe a little amorphous to call it ideological, but a very strong identification both as working class and as socialists, and even 6% of the millennials, or 2/3 of the 9%, identifying as communists.
No, this is extraordinary. I mean, you know, this is why I hesitate and am careful to use the German example of the 1930s and so on as a way of explaining what's going on here. It does not fit well. You know, one thing is, you know, none of us would be talking about Hitler were it not for World War II.
Right.
And the great devastation of, in particular, Europe and Asia as a consequence. But had Hitler remained a German phenomenon, we would not have been talking about him in the same way that we don't talk that much about Franco, and we don't talk in Spain and Salazar in Portugal, and only a little bit about Benito Mussolini in Italy. The fact of the matter is that the world is horrified by Hitler because of the war. I would suggest that if Trump is a fascist, then what do we call Hillary Clinton, who is completely committed to wars of intervention, not just in theory, but in practice, and is surrounded by foreign policy experts who are as committed to interventions, especially in the Middle East, as any neocon in the Bush administration, both Bush administrations. So, you know, in a lot of ways, it's something that we have to try to wrap our heads around. You know, I suggest that if it's a Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump race in the fall, and that's not guaranteed, of course, in a lot of ways, Trump would run to the left of Hillary Clinton, certainly on trade agreements like NAFTA and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, certainly on issues of non-intervention, and maybe on universal health care. I mean, you know, the thing is so much up in the air. But if there is a known commodity in this whole situation, it is Hillary Clinton. We know her. We know what she has done. We know her record in Honduras. We know the Clintons' record in Haiti. We know Hillary Clinton's record in Libya. We know what she had proposed for Syria, and just on and on and on. So I think that in a deep sense, Hillary Clinton, if you want to use the word fascist, Hillary Clinton represents institutional fascist forces, forces who have what we could call a fascist predisposition, but are in institutional positions of power. None of the other candidates, no matter how right-wing they might sound, like a Cruz or a Kasich, none of them has such a connection to institutional forces and power centers that, for all intents and purposes, we could call fascist. She is the friendly face of those forces.
You know, as one major example of this, if people look at their calendars, they'll see that AFRICOM was formed under the Bush administration about a month before the 2008 election, but it wasn't implemented until the Obama administration took office. And what that involved, essentially, was the U.S. negotiating, pressuring, strong-arming, whatever, achieving agreements with the individual African countries. Generally, that's done through the Department of State. So, you know, you don't send the generals over to say we're building a base. You send your Secretary of State and people in the State Department, your ambassadors. That was Hillary Clinton, because by the end of her term, the U.S. had command and control agreements with 35 African nations.
That's right. That's right. And you know, Don, you know, we'll take the 35, but then we have to look at particular countries and their function within AFRICOM. And I would address specifically Uganda and Rwanda, Museveni and Paul Kagame. And the reason I raise those two is because of the now almost 20-year war in the Eastern Congo, where anywhere up to 9 million people, I've recently learned, have been killed. A genocide of world historic dimension, and nobody talks about. And it's over the minerals in that part of the Congo. But the spearhead of this within AFRICOM, supplied by the U.S., by the Pentagon and U.S. war makers, are the regimes in Rwanda and in Uganda. Now, we could talk about other places like Nigeria, like Ethiopia, and Ethiopia's role in Somalia, Kenya's role in Somalia, and so on. I would agree with you.
You know, there's a particular, I would say, relationship of the Clintons with Rwanda, by the way, that people need to be reminded of.
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you know, they, just as a foundation and as individuals, they have staked out certain countries like Haiti, like Rwanda, for as their particular fiefdoms. And they are brutal. They are brutal. Assassinations, authoritarian regimes, failed states, and so on and so forth. You know, in fact, one could argue that Hillary Clinton has advanced the neocon project a step further and has created a policy that I think they call it humanitarian intervention, but it is really a policy of perpetual global chaos and conflict. And that's what her record is. No one else in this presidential cycle has such a record of supporting genocide, supporting authoritarian regimes, overthrowing regimes, and threatening and carrying out war. You know, it's very interesting how John Kerry replaces her and tries to moderate the policy and was continually undercut by the Clinton forces within the State Department. It's so obvious. So, yeah.
And you had people like Newland, who's married to one of the founders of the neocon movement,
absolutely.
Kagan, and
that's right.
One of the lead voices out of Clinton's Department of State, and very powerful. I don't know if opponent, but certainly a very powerful alternative center inside the State Department when Kerry takes over.
Oh yes, no question. And so we have these pro-fascist elements all throughout the State Department. Ukraine is not just another place. Ukraine is that line in the sand that first the Soviets and then the Russians drew after World War II. And the United States, and especially under people like Newland and indirectly Clinton, have transgressed that, even considering the agreement which the U.S. and the West made with Gorbachev, which so-called ended the Cold War, that NATO was not supposed to come to the borders of the Soviet Union. Well, now they are, and the plans are to bring the Ukraine into NATO. Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, and even going so far as to talk about bringing Georgia within NATO. I mean, this would literally be the military surrounding of Russia. which would only leave for Russia, in its own self-defense, the threat of using tactical nuclear weapons to defend the Soviets, I mean, the Russian state. I mean, this is very dangerous stuff. And I think Clinton is very much at the heart of it.
Yeah. The beginning of the Clinton administration was the beginning of the expansion of NATO with the agreement that was made with Bush concerned the reunification of Germany and the Soviet concerns about the integration of the eastern part of Germany into NATO.
Into
they were concerned
NATO.
That
That's
that
right.
would move the front forward, and that wasn't supposed to happen. Instead, they absorbed all of the states between Germany and Russia.
That's right. And of course, you know, Poland, you know, these countries like Poland and Ukraine have, you know, significant political symbolism going back to World War II. And of course, going back to the Russian Revolution, you know. Well, I think we're in dangerous territory, man.
If you take a train, I don't know if it's still true, but 25 years ago, I took a train from the Soviet Union to Warsaw. And at the frontier with Poland, we had to get off the train. They lift the car off the carriage and put it onto a new one because the Russians built the gauge of their railroad different from the rest of Europe so that Poland couldn't be used as a route of invasion with the mail cars.
Yes. That is significant. That is significant because, you know, World War II begins in 1939 when the Germans cross the agreed-upon line between the Soviet and German forces.
Yep.
Oh, this is huge. You know, this is why I'm not one of those people who is jumping on the bandwagon with this Trump is a fascist. Because I always ask the question, well, if he's a fascist, and he might be, then what is Hillary Clinton?
Right. Or Barack Obama or George Bush or Bill Clinton.
Well, and then the question is, then what is fascism?
Right. You go to the
American
dictionary.
Style.
Right. You know, well, first, fascism, as I understand it, is when the police power or the power of the state is applied against the economy in the interests of capital. With a repressive state structure to keep the working class from, you know, fighting back.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's true. And I think the most accurate definition was the one put forward by George Dimitrov. And he said, fascism is a terroristic dictatorship of the most aggressive and predatory elements of finance capital. And we might already be there.
We certainly have the most advanced finance capital sector in the history of the planet, and they have wrought the most destruction on the planet of anyone in history.
That's right, and we got the largest prison population in the world, and the most militarized police force in the world.
That's true.
And we have already the ideological conditions of fascism, racism, and the criminalization of immigrants, and especially African Americans and others. You know, I mean, the question is fascism just a slogan, or is it a way of understanding a mode of capitalist rule in a time of crisis?
Yeah, that's true. So we started out talking about big money in politics. I just heard today on the radio an interview with Andrew Coburn about an article he just wrote, and it apparently says the big money, which ends up being used for TV commercials, doesn't work. But in the process of saying it, he actually says it does work, because his thesis is that the advertising doesn't convince anyone of anything, and that's partially true. I would take question the negative ads certainly work, But really the part is that the amount of money that's spent on it is such a significant portion of the network's, the media's income, that it is tremendous influence over what the media covers. And he does touch on the conflict.
That's very interesting. That, in other words, it's like a form of cronyism, where you're buying the allegiance of the big media to the two-party duopoly.
Right. So, because I'm one of the people that buys ads for TV campaigns. You're a salesperson that runs buying department, the ad department, say at CNN. I drop $50 million dollars on you, and the next night I see that one of your reporters is trashing my candidate. Am I not making a phone call and canceling next week's buy?
Absolutely. Yeah. There it is.
So
there it is.
Now, with that, there's this contradiction this time, which is an interesting one, and it seems like they're having trouble mediating it. Trump has spent probably less money than all of them, certainly less than Bush and less than Rubio and others, and less than Clinton, and he's getting more coverage because he's an audience draw, and they have to give him coverage because that draws the audience and drives up the price of the advertising that's being sold to the other candidates.
And you know, see, the other thing is, and this is probably the genius of Trump, he turned the primary election season into a almost a moving town hall meeting on the anger of working class white people.
Yep.
And that is in itself newsworthy. I mean, you just can't avoid it, even if they didn't intend to give him all this attention. What was occurring was so newsworthy and so unusual that it had to be addressed just from the standpoint of journalism. So I think the Trump phenomenon changed everybody's thinking about what this electoral cycle would be. And he is a maverick. Let's not get it confused. I mean, you know, I could see, if he is the nominee and if Clinton is the nominee, that he would run against Clinton, but he would run to the left of Clinton, which is not all that hard. But he would not run in the same way that, let us say, a Cruz would run. He would run to the left of what Cruz or Kasich or Romney would do.
And, you know, Clinton, in terms of actual policy, other than social issues, is not much different from, say, Cruz, or more like, you know, go to Romney or some more traditional Republicans, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And Bernie Sanders running against one of those people, or Bernie Sanders running against Clinton as a Republican nominee, wouldn't be able to say, for example, let's reach a major peace agreement with Russia and China, and let's abrogate all these ugly trade agreements, etc., because he would be painted as a commie, a lefty, or whatever. But Trump has that space wide open to him, doesn't he?
Absolutely. 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 And he created that space. He really created it. I mean, you know, his idea of I can make the deal with Putin, I'll do this. Well, what he's saying, in essence, is that the ways that the State Department has negotiated is done in such a way that you don't intend to resolve, you know, dangerous international conflict, that you want to give the appearance of resolving things while continuing policies of regime change and military buildup and supporting the most dangerous, reactionary, even fascist regimes all over the world. You know?
Yep. So, what do you think's going to happen over the next week?
Well, It's hard to say. It's very hard.
Sure.
I think the next couple of weeks could be good weeks for Bernie Sanders. I don't think he did bad. I mean, they tied. You know, they keep tying, and the ties always go to Clinton. They tied in Missouri. They tied in Iowa. They virtually tied in Massachusetts. So there's a lot of corruption going on, a lot of vote stealing. But I think these next few weeks, a couple of weeks, should be good for Bernie Sanders. He has a lot of momentum. He seems energized. His crowds are still large. His supporters have not given up. On the other side, I think the Republican Party is in for some serious struggle. And Trump and his people don't seem to be backing up. They seem to be ready for whatever comes, and they're going to fight. They're going to fight, man. And it is a fight not for the soul of the Republican Party. It is a fight to bring down the Republican Party elites, and out of which no one can say what comes next. But I think the Trump people know at this point that this is not just a fight for a nomination. It is a fight that could, and not in an unintended way, more intended way, bring the Republican Party to its knees, out of which something new could emerge.
You know, they're showing on TV news that Clinton is almost double or better than double the number of delegates that Sanders has. But all of those totals include their estimate of the so-called superdelegates and how they're going to vote. The actual elected delegates are somewhere like 1,000 and change to 774, I think, for
Sanders.
Which reflects, and there's bonuses in there that Clinton got where the tie went to Clinton, so that the actual popular sentiment among Democrats is pretty evenly divided. Now, if they engineer a theft of or a taking of the, the nomination for Clinton, and anger the left inside the Democratic Party, or all the left that's left, the Sanders supporters in the Democratic Party, what do you think are the prospects of those people voting for Trump and or third parties?
I think that's a possibility. I think all of those things are possible, or not voting for the top of the ticket at all, not voting for president at all. Mm. And choosing the path of organization and mass demonstrations and civil disobedience. I think Bernie's going to have to get a little more angry. I think he's not angry enough yet. I think he is not saying to his people what has to be said to prepare them for what's next. And I think he already kind of sabotaged himself in the beginning by saying he would support whoever the candidate was. Now, of course, he can change that, and the possibilities that he will. But I think his movement and he personally are going to have to get more angry in this struggle with Clinton. Take the gloves off. You've been too kind. You've been too soft in dealing with her.
And I'm looking forward to seeing you on the streets of Philadelphia outside that convention.
Yeah.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.